Today at Reader's Corner, we're continuing our conversation with Holocaust survivor and international lawyer Samuel Pisar, author of the memoir Of Blood and Hope.
You cannot live what I have lived and not have such thoughts. You ask yourself if, God forbid, there couldn't be a final solution for mankind if things go out of control. If Solzhenitsyn cannot write, if Sakharov cannot speak, then the salesman cannot sell, and the engineer cannot produce, and ideas cannot circulate. You cannot have a closed, grim fortress and develop economically.
I'm Bob Kustra, president of Boise State University. Welcome to Reader's Corner. For those of you who joined us last week, you heard one of the most riveting interviews I've ever done on radio. Samuel Pisar was one of the youngest survivors of the Holocaust, and he went on to become a world-renowned international lawyer and an advisor to President John F. Kennedy. Dr. Pisar died July 27th in New York City at the age of 86, just a few weeks before the world paused to remember the 70th anniversary of the end of World War II. I interviewed Sam Pisar in 2005 when he visited Boise State as a featured speaker at the university's Frank Church Conference on Public Affairs. The interview was intended to last 30 minutes, but we extended it to an hour to allow him to finish telling his extraordinary story. To this day, it remains the most memorable interview I've done at Reader's Corner. Today, we're airing the second half of that conversation in this encore presentation. In last week's show, Dr. Pisar described how he managed to survive the Nazi death camps and ultimately escape. In today's concluding segment, he discusses how he rebuilt his life after the war ended, his later work as an international lawyer, and his concerns about the growing threat of global terrorism. We continue that discussion now. In your book, Of Blood and Hope, you said that you fear the madness you lived through as a teenager is creeping back upon us in many irresistible, insidious forms, pushing us toward untold Holocaust on a world scale. What did you mean by that?
Well, it was not a prophecy, but it was a premonition. You cannot live what I have lived and not have such thoughts, particularly if you become an educated man, experienced, aware of how the world works, how politics work. You see atomic bombs exploding, you see mushroom clouds, you see weapons of mass destruction being built here and there. And you have a tendency to ask yourself such questions as, there was a final solution for the Jewish people. That was what Hitler called the fate that he had prepared for us. You ask yourself if, God forbid, there couldn't be a final solution for mankind if things go out of control. I have seen a world collapse, my world. I've seen everything destroyed around me. Today I see a world that is inflamed again. There is no comparison. But you see terrorism, you see beheadings, you see suicide bombings, you see all kinds of horrors.
Well, you see genocide.
And genocides in ex-Yugoslavia,
Rwanda.
In Rwanda, before that in Cambodia, in Sudan. And you ask yourself, is it possible that the past is becoming present? I don't want to be alarming. As I say, I have a happy family, I have children. I even have grandchildren now. So it works on me. And I feel an obligation to testify what I think I have learned from my experience. Hence the phrase that you have just read. And one of the reasons I am in Boise today for this conference and to honor my old friend, Senator Frank Church, is because this is one of the themes that I want to address here as well.
After your liberation from the Nazis, you were offered the opportunity to go to Israel, and I believe you declined. Why was that?
Because I was alone. I didn't know where to go, because I surely didn't want to go back to my home city. There was nothing there but ashes. And it was occupied by the Red Army, and I had enough of totalitarian regimes. I was trying to get my anger out of my system, so I was living this wild freedom in the ruins of post-war Germany, riding around the freeways on a powerful motorcycle and still defying death. But then something strange happened. A French aunt, sister of my mother, who was looking for survivors, saw the name Samuel Pizarre on a list prepared by the chaplain of the 8th Army, commanded by General Bradley. And she was asking herself, she couldn't sleep, who is Samuel Pizarre? There was a David Pizarre, there was a this Pizarre and that Pizarre, all big, husky men. There was a little boy called Samuel. He wouldn't be more than 15 or 16 today. Couldn't be him. How would he have survived if the others, the giants, didn't? But she couldn't sit still, so she started to look for the Samuel Pizarre, and finally she found me. I was glad she found me, and yet I wasn't thrilled, because I was not ready to take on family again. I'd had enough. But she was afraid the way I lived, the dangers around me. And one day she pointed a finger at me and she said, "Listen, young man, I am speaking with the authority of your mother, my sister. You're going to leave this life and you are coming with me." I wondered who this lady was to speak to me with such authority. You know, at that moment, after liberation, I didn't like any form of authority.
I'm sure.
But I had enough sense to listen to the message and where it came from. So I went with her to Paris, and then she shipped me off to her two brothers in Australia, my uncles, because they decided among them, without telling me, that it was important to get me away as far from Europe as possible, so I wouldn't be reminded of what was going on there, and that is where salvation came. That is where I resumed my studies and decided that now I may have survived physically, but that is not survival, that I had to survive morally and intellectually. And that was the beginning of my rise, forgive the expression, from the ashes into the stratosphere. Mm-hmm. And that's what ultimately brought me to Harvard, to the Sorbonne, and to Washington, and to all the other things.
You're listening to an interview from our archives with Samuel Pizarre, and obviously he is a Holocaust survivor and an internationally renowned attorney and a scholar. But you returned to Auschwitz. First of all, how do you pull that off? Was that difficult in itself, going back? Your message, I believe, in your address, you said, "The spot on which we stand is the deepest wound ever inflicted upon human civilization, the place where grim reality eclipsed Dante's vision of hell."
I returned on that occasion because a lot of pressure was put upon me. It was an ecumenical conference of rabbis, priests and cardinals, and imams of Islam. And I was asked to give the keynote address. I was reluctant, but they said, "Only you dares to speak with authority in Auschwitz. And I accepted to do it. Now, how did it feel? It was not pleasant. I went with my wife, Judith, who gave me a lot of moral support. But, as you can imagine, having lived what I had lived, I have strong nerves. And what you do in a situation like this is that you anesthetize yourself. So it was more difficult for my wife than for me. But I stood there and made that speech, and it was an unusual moment because for once in that cursed and sacred place, Jews, Christians, and Muslims sat and talked about the kind of issues that you would expect them to talk about today. That was before 9/11. I wish there were ways to resume these kind of dialogues today so as to calm down a little the hatred and violence that is in the air and that, God forbid, could lead to new dramas.
I know you heard earlier today reference to the fact that the day or so after 9/11 here in Boise, people of all faiths formed a human chain and gathered around the Islamic Center here in Boise to protect those who might be victims of someone coming out of nowhere.
Well, this is noble and marvelous, and these voices, these messages, must make themselves heard much more. You know, the world out there is not exactly Boise, unfortunately. So what we need to hear is from the heart of Islam, a great religion. We are hearing too much from the fanatics who parade as holy men and who have a political agenda that is creating havoc in Islam and for the rest of us. And I think that the quickest solution could come from the heart of Islam itself.
So you think there's a reluctance there to date?
To speak up? Well, I am sure that there are some thoughtful, decent people, many of them there, but perhaps they don't dare to speak up. Some have, but it has to come from there. It cannot just come from our talking at them. We have to build bridges there to put things back on even keel.
Speaking of religious conflict, if you will, in 1998, you presented an award to the Cardinal of Paris on behalf of the Center for Christian-Jewish Understanding. I suppose that award came as a result of earlier problems that Jews and Christians had going back all the way to World War II when Pius XII has been accused of everything, including complicity. Could you explain to us what you
were? Well, it went further back than that. You know, it went...
You can take it
with 2,000 years.
Yeah, right.
Because the first phase of anti-Semitism was religious, and that spread, and then it became racist. And, of course, it culminated in the Holocaust. And Pope Pius XII was unacceptably passive. And it was only John the 23rd, whom I had known personally, because he had been the apostolical nuncio of the Vatican.
Cardinal Roncalli, was it?
Cardinal Roncalli at the time. And he was the ambassador not only to France, but to UNESCO. And I was legal counsel to UNESCO at that time, at the age of 26. And I would go to his receptions, And I had conversations with him. I never imagined that he would become the Pope. But he was a remarkable man because he saved many Jewish children during the war. He was a total contrast with Pope Pius XII. And of course, when Roncalli became Pope, he was the spirit of the Nostra Aetate that took out these anti-Semitic elements from the catechism and opened an era of Christian-Jewish understanding. And Cardinal Lustiger was the Archbishop of Paris, and a convert from Judaism. He was one of the Jewish children whose parents, whose mother had been killed at Auschwitz like mine, who ended up with the priests, and they converted him to Catholicism. But being a faithful Catholic, he also played an important role with the last Pope, John Paul, to widen the dialogue between Christians and Jews and to do a mea culpa, where the Catholic Church assumed responsibility for its unsatisfactory attitude during the Holocaust. And the Jewish community of the United States wanted to honor him for that. And I was asked to give him the honor in the presence of the Cardinal of New York and several other cardinals. And I made the speech to recognize that contribution to Jewish-Christian understanding that is still very much alive now and which is being continued by Pope Benedict. I am very interested in these religious affairs. That was the reason for that.
You're listening to an interview from our archives with Samuel Pisar, one of the youngest survivors of the Holocaust and an advisor to President John F. Kennedy. He died last month at age 86. Now, your native land was Poland, and the Poles have had a difficult time overcoming charges of anti-Semitism, both here in America and abroad. Where are we today? Did John Paul have any impact on that?
He must have, because John Paul was an extraordinary man, and I remind you, he was older than I, but he was born and lived and acted as a priest close by to Auschwitz, near Krakow, on the other side of the barbed wire. Mm-hmm. So he saw what was going on there. In fact, as a child, he went to a Jewish school there in the village of Wadowice that became so world famous. And in his class, there were 26 Jewish children. He grew up with them. He had never forgotten this, and he had never forgotten the suffering that he had seen. So he was very sincerely pushing for a new attitude towards Jews. And that, of course, had an impact in Poland also, because the feeling about Jews was that the Poles were a little bit too indifferent about what was happening to the Jews. And then there was a lot of aggravation because all the homes that were emptied of Jews were occupied by Poles, and it was a mess. But now it is better, and I hope that this move towards reconciliation will continue. I think it's well on the way.
You've had an incredible career. Your book, Coexistence in Commerce, Transactions Between East and West, you've been credited with influencing Nixon and Kissinger's policies toward China, the Soviet Union, and Eastern Europe. I know there's not time to give us most of that book, but I'm fascinated what advice you would have given them through the book, that is, or maybe you even had an opportunity to deliver that personally. But what impact do you think you made on their thinking? And of course, we all know how Kissinger's thinking on China had tremendous influence on Nixon. There's that old saying that no one could have gone to China but Nixon, because Nixon would have stopped anybody else from opening up China. Your thoughts?
I can only tell you this. My wife and I went to China a couple of years ago, and we were invited. And the first morning after our arrival, we were taken to the People's Palace on Tiananmen Square. And before I knew what was happening, I was put in the armchair of Mao Zedong, which stood next to a similar armchair in which Mao received Nixon in 1972. So later I asked, what do I owe this honor to? And I was told, because we have read the World Press, you have evidently inspired Nixon's trip, and coexistence and commerce is more relevant to us today than when you wrote the book 32 years ago. Of course, it didn't hurt that I was the general counsel of the International Olympic Committee, because
we know what they're looking at.
They wanted the games for the year 2008 and so on.
Right.
But this is only another way of saying that during the Cold War, when I was a doctoral candidate at Harvard, I decided to write my thesis on how economic relations can be developed between capitalist and communist countries so as to take the fuses out of the nuclear arms race. Remember where I came from and what was driving me. And that thesis was later expanded into the book. And when I saw that unbelievable review on the front page of the New York Times of that book, I was flabbergasted, but their national security advisor read it. He evidently made a 40-page summary and sent it up to Nixon. What they did among themselves, I can't tell you, and I won't, but evidently it had an impact. That became a doctrine, the European version of the book, because it was published in many languages, was called not Coexistence and Commerce, but Weapons of Peace. You understand the idea. And the thesis was that the best way to try to make peace between what I would call hereditary enemies, historic sworn hereditary enemies, was with the development of constructive relationships that go from trade to investments to tourism to sport to all kinds of cultural exchanges. But the most concrete aspect of it, of course, is trade. And this is how you develop man to man, company to company, country to country, mutually interested relationships that are very difficult to tear apart, because a lot of careers and a lot of money and a lot of investment rides on it. And if you look at the art of peacemaking in the last few decades, you see that this became a method that has produced results. It happened between the Germans and the French after three tremendous bloodbaths. Today in the European community, for France and Germany to make war with one another is like stabbing at its own body. It worked between the Chinese and the Japanese. It worked between the Americans and the Russians. It is working now. Mm-hmm. We consider the Russians business partners. It worked in South Africa after Mandela and de Klerk, where they see a new horizon and they are working towards peace. It is working for the Catholics and the Protestants in Ireland. Mm-hmm. And now, even between the Pakistanis and the Indians. So why not between Arabs and Jews? Mm-hmm. And I believe that sooner or later, the Palestinians and the Israelis will settle down to this kind of a doctrine, that they will gradually bring into a regional common market, probably Jordan and Lebanon and Egypt and maybe Syria, mm-hmm. and that this will happen because they are not going to sacrifice another generation or two in a futile, self-destructive situation.
You're listening to Reader's Corner. Today we're featuring an interview from our archives with Samuel Pisar, a Holocaust survivor, lawyer, and author of the memoir Of Blood and Hope. Mr. Pisar died last month in New York City.
Maybe you haven't gone as far as I'm going to suggest here, but I would assume there might be some human rights activists out there that might take on your thesis regarding China, for example, especially after Tiananmen Square.
They have taken it on.
Okay, I thought
they
so.
They have taken it on, and a lot. Mm-hmm. But what has really happened, and that is the thrust that I have been defending personally on both continents all this time, that if a totalitarian system, as Eastern Europe and Russia used to be, wants to integrate itself into the global economy and benefit from it, they have to soften up on their own people. I said that often in Washington and in Moscow, in the time of the Cold War, when visas were being refused to dissidents and to Jews to leave Russia, when they were put in gulags and in prisons. And my friend Frank Church was part of this idea. He thought the same way. We have often worked along the same lines. If a manager cannot manage, if an inventor cannot invent, if Solzhenitsyn cannot write, if Sakharov cannot speak, then the salesman cannot sell, and the engineer cannot produce, and ideas cannot circulate. You cannot sustain an economy. You cannot be in trade. And that has worked, and that is perhaps more than anything else that opened up Russia and Eastern Europe. And I think it is almost inevitable today. You know how many Chinese have personal computers? You know how many of them are sending out blogs and the internet? You cannot have a closed, grim fortress and develop economically. And I think that they will go, sooner or later, in the same direction.
This time, we have run out of time, and you have been very generous with your time. I really appreciate this. You are an eloquent spokesman for humanity, and we thank you for joining us here at Boise State and at the Frank Church Conference.
Thank you very much.
I hope you enjoyed this encore edition of our interview with Samuel Pisar. Next week, Chad Harback, author of the best-selling novel, The Art of Fielding. The engineer for today's show is Eric Jones, research by Kathleen Tuck. Our producer is Janelle Brown. I'm Bob Kustra. Please join me next week as we talk to today's leading writers about the ideas and issues that help shape our world at Reader's Corner. You can find out more about our show and sign up for weekly podcasts at BoiseStatePublicRadio.org. Search for Reader's Corner.